Ready to hear argument in Amalgamated Transit versus City of Colorado Springs.
May it please the court, and I apologize for my voice. My name is Tom Buescher. My registration number is 6796. I'm here representing Local 19, the plaintiff in this case. With me at council table is co-counsel Naomi Pereira. The facts and the history of this case, which is familiar to Judge Webb from the earlier decision, are all set forth in the brief. I'm going to focus on two issues in my prepared remarks, the standing issue and particularly injury in fact portion of the standing issue, and then the district court's ruling on the unconstitutionality of the provision of the Section 13C agreement. As this court is well aware, standing requires both an injury in fact, and the injury has to be to a legally protected interest. It is the injury in fact issue that is the most troubling from the plaintiff's point of view, from our point of view in this case. The Supreme Court in Amesco held that you have to have a concrete adverseness, and that means that you can't have the remote possibility of an injury or something that is overly indirect or incidental to the defendant's actions. Now, the first thing you have to ask yourself is, what are the defendant's actions in this case? Us being the plaintiff, but the defendant on the counterclaim in this case. What actions did we take? The only actions that we took is that related to that provision of the contract is we are a party to that contract. We signed it back in 1981, just like the city did. The other thing, then, you must remember is that the language that the court declared unconstitutional does not apply to the city.
Let me ask a question. As I read your brief, you concede that if interest arbitration occurred, ultimately the city could be liable for the recipient, for non-payment of benefits by the recipient to employees, even though you point out that it is an extremely attenuated set of circumstances that would get there. Am I reading the brief correctly?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
All right, so, but that clause, the arbitration clause, in whole does not apply to the city, as the earlier decision of the district court and one of the very few admitted facts in this record before you shows, okay, the arbitration doesn't exist versus the city of Colorado Springs. So the city is claiming that a clause to which it is not a party, does not apply to it, is somehow causing it an injury in fact.
Mr. Buescher, is the standing issue analyzed the same, whether it's applied to the plaintiff's initial claim or defendant's counterclaim? Is that analysis the same or is it different?
Well, the legal analysis is the same. The initial claim of the plaintiff was a breach of contract action against the city of Colorado Springs, claiming that when it negotiated a contract with a now predecessor operator of the transit system, it relieved that operator of the obligations under the Section 13C agreement, and that action was a violation of that Section 13C agreement by the City of Colorado Springs. It focuses only on that particular act and those one or two clauses, not clause though 15.
While you're on that point, let's assume solely for purposes of discussion that we affirm the trial court summary judgment on unconstitutionality as limited to the interest. Is there anything left of your breach of contract claim, and if so, what's left of it?
Yes, there is. Well, it really depends. We have argued in our brief that all the district court did, and I will have candidly admit that reading the decision, this is not obvious on its face, but the district court declared the interest arbitration provision of paragraph 15 unconstitutional. Now, paragraph 15 is a broad arbitration clause that involves both rights and interest arbitration, and it has another sentence in it that's very important that this court recognized in its first decision, and that is a sentence that says that while there is this dispute pending over a new contract, the existing terms and conditions cannot be changed. So in that context, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I've lost track of where I was going with that. I must apologize. But I really think that where you are is paragraph 15, what was declared unconstitutional by the trial court is very limited, and it still leaves us to be able to argue unconstitutional, that the city, by removing the interest arbitration, also then potentially removed that sentence and the obligation to maintain the status quo during the negotiations, and that may have caused harm to the plaintiff and its members. That's the damage claim that was part of the initial lawsuit before this court.
But you'd agree the court is far from clear. Act in the single sentence.
It is clearly invalidated interest arbitration. How broad the district court interpreted that is unclear from its decision. Yes. Excuse me. Okay. Well, the district court based its injury in fact analysis, and this is in its decision denying our motion to dismiss the counterclaim for lack of standing, that on two really bases. One of them was the city had to spend attorney's fees to defend the initial breach of contract action. The two cases cited by the district court to support that proposition quite candidly have nothing to do with it, and we can find no cases, and the city has certainly cited no cases that suggest that having to defend a separate breach of contract action gives standing to challenge an entirely separate portion of a contract. The other part of the district court's decision was it correctly pointed out in the Romo decision how an injury need only be threatened. It doesn't have to be actual. One doesn't have to wait to be harmed under the Declaratory Judgment Act. But the court then said, as Judge Webb has pointed out, that if the private contractor ultimately doesn't pay some of these employee protections, the city is ultimately liable, and that is the threatened injury. But what the court didn't point out in the Romer decision is it's got to be a direct and palatable threat, not one that's indirect, remote, or uncertain. Now, the district court's holding is directly contrary to the Farmers Insurance Exchange case decided back in 1993. There, a plaintiff in an automobile accident litigation filed a separate declaratory judgment action against the insurance carrier for the defendant in the personal injury case over the limits in that policy. And the Supreme Court said, there's no standing here because the rights of the plaintiff are contingent on the happening event, which cannot be forecast and which may never take place. That is this case.
Is it this case, though, insofar as the city's counterclaims here are really defensive, not offensive? I mean, in Farmers, the person involved in the accident brought the claim, and therefore his or her standing would be subject to the highest standard. Here, you brought the claim. The city has raised, by counterclaim, although I think it also could have just been an affirmative defense, that some or all of your contract is unenforceable, is unconstitutional. Well, I mean, doesn't that lead us down to a less demanding standing analysis where it's purely defensive?
I am aware of no law that says that a counterclaim raised by a defendant is subject to any lesser standing analysis than if they had brought that lawsuit as an initial declaratory judgment.
Suppose they only pleaded unconstitutionality as an affirmative defense rather than a counterclaim. And then wouldn't it be subject to a lower standing level of standing scrutiny?
I'm not sure that the label makes any difference, Your Honor. Again, I'm not aware of any case law that indicates the label makes any difference. I think it is a claim, there's an affirmative claim that something is unconstitutional under the Declaratory Judgment Act. It's the only way they could make that anyway.
Why couldn't they just say at some point it probably is a summary judgment? Well, you would not necessarily agree, but it could be a summary judgment. Why couldn't they just say, Your Honor, this contract is unenforceable. It's unconstitutionality is the reason why it's unenforceable, and they wouldn't have to plead anything. That'd just be a matter of argument.
I cannot give an answer to that question, Your Honor.
Thank you. I apologize for interrupting you.
No, no, that's fine. I fully expect it. All right. Now I'm going to get to the constitutionality argument quickly. The court declared that the interest arbitration clause is unconstitutional, and it must then have found that there was an improper delegation of legislative authority. Not everything the city does is unconstitutional. It's got to be an improper delegation of legislative authority. That was the argument the city made. That's the argument the court adopted. And what the court said was that the city effectively ceded its constitutional obligation to determine the terms of its contract. And that was the unconstitutional delegation. How did it do that? By agreeing to this formula that we've talked about how employee protections might be paid if the various events triggering them occurred. That was the term of the contract that the court said that the city agreed, the actual calculation of the amount. Well, quite candidly, the city agreed to that formula back in 1981. And basically what the district court is saying is any formulaic agreement for calculating damages or employee protections or anything like that, that vests a portion of the formula in someone other than the city, would be an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority, which basically then says that the city has the legislative authority to determine all of those things that might be part of the formula. In this case, the legislative authority to determine the pay of private sector employees. And to state that states its absurdity. Of course the city doesn't have that legislative authority. It agreed to this contract back in 1981, and it agreed to this formula. It's a rational way of doing this. It could have agreed to something else. It didn't have to agree to anything, quite candidly. It just needed some employee protection provisions. So the court is basically wrong in the district court about that legislative authority. There is no legislative authority involved in this case by the city of Colorado Springs once it agreed to that contract back in 1981, an event that it doesn't claim was somehow improper.
Are you saying that the formula is unchanged and unchangeable since 1981?
It is unchanged since 1981.
Even though
the current Section 13C contract, it has not.
No, the contract with there's no contract with the recipient, correct?
Well, there was a contract with the recipient when this case was filed. Now there is a question of that contract because of a whole set of circumstances that have occurred since then, Your Honor. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Robert Mack, attorney number 017529. May it please the court. There are two issues that the city thinks are important for the court. First is that the 13C arbitration clause is so embedded in the structure and very essence of this 13C agreement that severance, which is what the court did, destroys the entire contract. The other point is that this 13C agreement is a perpetual municipal contract. It is, in fact, void under Colorado law per the Cherokee Water District case.
Second point is your second counterclaim, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, how is that properly before us, given that in general, denial of a summary judgment is not an appealable order, and here specifically there's been no 54B certification that would place the ruling on your second counterclaim before us?
Well, not all judgments need to be certified as being final by the court below in order to come. Any final judgment can be appealed. In this case, this was a final judgment that it determined a matter strictly of law based on the decision of the Colorado Supreme Court. And that decision of law, in fact, depending on how it was ruled on, had been ruled in the city's favor, was dispositive of the entire case. So it, in effect, is a final judgment, and as such, it can be appealed further.
How can it be appealed if it's entered in an ongoing multi-claim case? I mean, isn't that the essence of 54B, that if you've got multiple claims, a judgment as to one claim can't be appealed absent the 54B certification?
Perhaps, but in this case, you had the court below ruling and actually certifying the order that involved two matters. It involved the question of whether or not the contract was perpetual. It also involved the question of the arbitration agreement. In effect, what the court did was certified its order. Now, it may be true that ATU was asking about the section that pertained mostly to the arbitration clause, but in fact, the two are tied together. The arbitration is, in fact, part of the clause, and if, in fact, the entire contract is void under the ruling of the Supreme Court, then that also settles the issue that was being appealed by the ATU. So it also comes in through that door. Further, there was no objection made in accord with the state law. And therefore, as we read the state law, by failing to object, the ATU has lost any ability to argue now that there is no jurisdiction. And that makes sense when you look at the state law and that the legislature has designated what authority this court has. Well, it wouldn't make any sense for the legislature then turn around and say that if within so many days of the record being filed, one of the parties does not object to jurisdiction, then that the ability to object is waived. Basically, what that does is that gives this court the ability to proceed with jurisdiction, whether or not the issue was, in fact, properly before the court in the beginning. When you look at the arbitration clause and you look at the 13C agreement, if you read the 13C agreement carefully, the last clauses, you find out that this arbitration clause covers any and every controversy arising out of or by virtue of any provision of the 13C agreement, including every paragraph of the 13C agreement itself. So this arbitration paragraph, which the ATU has constantly tried in its briefs to distinguish as merely being a clause that has an interest arbitration component and a non-interest arbitration component, it is an arbitration paragraph. It is, in fact, a paragraph that requires the city to take certain actions because the 13C agreement makes the city legally responsible for making any payments that might flow from that arbitration contract. So what happens here, Your Honor, is that you can't separate out that arbitration clause from the rest of the agreement. If you look at any paragraph, take any paragraph of that 13C agreement and then say, okay, let's have a dispute between two of the three parties, the city and the ATU, or ATU and the contractor, known as the recipient. How does that settle? Read 13C agreement carefully, you find out that it is settled by going back to this arbitration paragraph.
It's possible, though, to just sever the provisions in the arbitration paragraph that relate to the interest arbitration as opposed to the other grievance dispute type of arbitration?
No. And the reason is that there are no provisions in the paragraph itself that relate specifically to interest arbitration. There's nothing that says if you have an interest arbitration issue, then this is the procedure you use. The arbitration paragraph is exactly that. It says if there is a dispute, a controversy of any kind over any issue, including collective bargaining agreements, and the city's not even a party to collective bargaining agreements. The employees involved are not city employees. Any dispute like that comes in under this arbitration clause. This clause is so broad that virtually any dispute that comes up is going to result in basically as an interest arbitration situation, and it's going to be held against the city for whatever decision that the arbitration panel makes. And because under Colorado law, as long as the arbitrator proceeds properly, there's no review of the arbitrator's decision, you now have a situation where even if the city is saying, well, wait a minute, we didn't have anything to do with this, you know, we don't appropriate funds for this, that very decision, if you look at the paragraph that says the city is responsible, well, that very paragraph falls under this arbitration clause. It becomes a dispute or controversy arising out of or as part of the 13C agreement. It goes back to an arbitration provision an arbitration provision which, in fact, the city is not even a party to, the selection of the parties who are doing that, and then decisions made, and the city is held liable on the cost. Presumably, then, under an arbitration decision, be enforced by the trial courts and this court against the city. So you basically have an unlawful delegation there of the city's financial wherewithal of deciding how its tax money is going to be spent. You have a situation where you can have collusion between the ATU and the recipient.
So, are you saying that if ATU and the contractor, which we're calling the recipient, entered into an arm's-length collective bargaining agreement without invoking the interest arbitration provision, that arbitration of labor disputes arising under that agreement, grievance arbitration, is unlawful because ultimately the city might have to pay for some of that arbitration award?
No, what happened, Your Honor, is it would work like this. The city council appropriates, say, $10 million for the operation of bus fixed route services. The ATU and the contractor, who, for purposes, let's say, our argument is hostile to the city, they are having contract problems with the city, decide that they're going to go in the next collective bargaining agreement, and they're going to bump the wages of each driver up by $25 an hour. So now you have a contract that's going to cost $15 million. Okay, now, if the city says, well, we're not going to pay that, so the contractor says, we're not going to pay that, so the ATU says, okay, fine, let's arbitrate. They waltz into arbitration. The ATU says, this is what was agreed. The contractor says, well, yeah, gee, that's what was agreed. The arbitrator says, okay, if that was agreed, I'm imposing this. It's now a $15 million contract. Then they come back against the city under the payment clause and say, now, city, you are responsible for making this payment.
But I mean, isn't that the consequence of the city's decision to hire a contractor rather than to negotiate directly with ATU?
No, and the reason is that the city, as a home rule municipality, is not required to engage in collective bargaining agreements. But under the way that works with the federal law, if these drivers were to come into city employment, they would bring their collective bargaining rights, including the right to strike, into their employment at the city. The city charter, which is basically the law for the city for matters of local concern, which it says prohibits strikes. Therefore, by bringing these workers in, you would basically be destroying a section of the city charter, which is not a proper activity. So no, you don't ever have the possibility or situation of these being city workers or the city negotiating directly with the union. In fact, the city does not recognize unions, not even the police union or the fire union.
And enter it, choose.
It does not, and it's not required to under Colorado law. I suppose it could choose to recognize a union as a legislative matter, but again, under home rule authority, that's a decision strictly for the city council.
I'm not sure, though, you've answered my question. It seems to me that the problem you posit is a consequence of the city hiring a contractor to run the bus system who would have its own employees rather than dealing directly with the union.
No. This problem would exist even if the city were the employer and the union were there. You would still have the situation of the union saying, well, now we want these wages. The city saying, well, we can't afford to pay these wages. And then the union saying, okay, now we want arbitration, or going to the arbitrator and having the arbitrator make the decision.
But if the city dealt directly with the union, either they would reach agreement or they wouldn't. If the trial court's right that there's no interest arbitration, then there's no agreement. If the city chooses to negotiate with the union, then why isn't it bound by the consequent by grievance arbitration arising under its contract?
It might be bound by grievance arbitration. However, that's not the legal situation we have before us, Your Honor. The city is not the employer, and therefore any determination what would happen if the city were is mere speculation.
How can the city create a defense to the 13C agreement that it wouldn't have directly by delegating to a contractor the negotiation with the union? In other words, it seems to me you conceded that if there was no contractor in this equation and the city dealt directly with the union, it would be bound by grievance arbitration. You're saying, as I understand it, because the city deals through a contractor, then the grievance arbitration creates a legislative delegation problem. I'm troubled that it seems to me the city chooses a course of action, the end game of which you're saying is to evade or invalidate the 13C agreement.
If I understand what your Honor is saying correctly, now the fact that you might have a grievance arbitration situation does not mean that the city would necessarily be bound by that determination. Whether or not these are city employees or not city employees. What is key here is that the agreement itself, the city is theoretically bound, if it's legal, by the agreement to make all payments that are determined by an arbitrator. It's determined by an arbitrator with whom the city is not involved in the selection. And that is a clear violation of the Colorado law. The provision is so embedded in the agreement that you can't take it out. Now, in the briefs, the ATU's argument was more about whether or not it's interest arbitration or not on the severance issue. The real issue that we have here is not so much the severance. The issue is whether or not the city ATU agreement is in fact void because you can't take that paragraph out. The ATU, even as we speak, the city's been sued in the Denver courts by the ATU and basically our provider. ATU sued the provider for arbitration under this very paragraph. They then removed to federal court. They then added the city as a third-party defendant. And the argument, apparently, as far as we can tell from our own provider, is that the city is bound to indemnify the provider for any and every cost that may be decided in the arbitration. The problem is that when you have this arbitration clause, it goes beyond just grievance or interest arbitration. It places the entire determination of the legislative ability of the city to determine how it's going to spend tax money on the shoulders of the arbitrator who is not selected and not answerable to the electorate, and then imposes those costs upon the city. It's invalid, it's unconstitutional, and because it's so deeply in the agreement fails, as we alluded to in our brief. The other point we wanted to make on the issue of whether or not the contract is perpetual and therefore void, we think that the Supreme Court's pronouncement in the Cherokee case was clear.
The actual agreement had in perpetuity, did it not? The language in perpetuity for the sales of the water?
The issue that the court looked at was not whether or not it had it in perpetuity in it. The issue was that the court grafted an exception. The court said that under the Colorado Constitution, the right to hold water is perpetual.
Right.
And therefore, the court interpreted that to mean that you could have a perpetual contract or a contract.
I understand that, but this case isn't about the sale of water. And right. So when you look at Cherokee, in that case, another difference is that there is the in perpetuity language, where it was my understanding that there wasn't such language in this particular agreement.
That's correct. This agreement has no language on termination of any type. So, and it's a standalone agreement. It's not tied to any particular project or how many projects it may be applied to. And I see my time is up. But thank you.
I want to quickly address the severance argument and note, first of all, that the city has been unable to cite any cases that find that an illegal arbitration clause, whether it be interest or otherwise, is not severable from a contract. The Colorado law looks at the purpose of the overall agreement and whether the challenge clause is essential to that overall agreement. let's make sure everyone understands what this, the 13C agreement is for. It's designed to do two things. It's designed to protect employee rights from when they were used to be private employees, but historically then cities took over transit systems. There was different laws relating to public employee bargaining than private employee bargaining. Congress said, we want to protect those rights. Secondly, it said, in order to do that, we will allow the city, we will give it federal money. An immense amount of federal money can go to a city over time. This agreement's been in effect since 1981. And the city has received an immense amount of money under this agreement. So that's the purpose of this agreement. The arbitration language, whether it be the interest arbitration or even the rights arbitration portions of it, relates simply to an enforcement mechanism. And enforcement mechanisms, we are unaware of any law that they are so tied up in an agreement that has a purpose like the 13C agreement has, that they cannot be severed. This agreement is clearly severable if it were unconstitutional. And again, we believe that the agreement is not unconstitutional, even the interest arbitration provisions, for the reasons set forth in the brief and here today. We ask that this court reverse the decision of the trial court, that first of all, it declare that the trial, that the city has no standing to raise this particular challenge to the 13C agreement, but even if it does, that the agreement is not unconstitutional. Thank you.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. A written opinion will be issued in due course. Counsel in this case are